Registration is now open for the 2018 Apologetics Canada Conference. The conference is located in beautiful Abbotsford, British Columbia on March 2nd and 3rd. We have another amazing lineup of speakers. Get all the details and register at apologeticscanadaconference.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the AC Podcast. This is Steve Kim.
Andy Steiger.
Terry Crosby.
Here we are, the three men with faces for podcasting, here to...
Thanks, Steve.
Yeah, nothing like starting the day with a bit of a jab at everybody, including myself. We have a special guest on the line all the way from Houston, Texas. If you are a regular follower of Apologetics Canada, and if you've been following our conference, annual conference, you know this name. We have on the line Nancy Piercy. Nancy is a best-selling author and speaker, and she is professor of apologetics and scholar in residence at Houston Baptist University. She's the editor-at-large of the Piercy Report, a fellow at the Discovery Institute, Center for Science and Culture. She's written a number of books that have been very influential for many of us, including us here at Northview Community Church. In fact, her book, Total Truth, is required reading for all the interns here. And that book has won the Evangelical Christian Publishers Association's Gold Medallion Award. And she's written other books, including The Soul of Science, which personally I found very helpful in my research on the relationship between science and religion. Saving Leonardo, Finding Truth. Finding Truth was the book that Nancy had just launched when she was speaking at our conference a couple of years ago, or 3 years ago almost now. So welcome here, Nancy.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Nancy, it is so good to have you on the show. I actually got to tell you, you know, your book, Soul of Science, introduced me to Michael Polanyi, in whom I've been doing my PhD work on for the last 3 years. So I owe you a debt. Thank you.
I'm so glad that you found Michael Polanyi. He is a great thinker and writer, and he did a lot to help start the intelligent design movement, though he may not know that. He was the first person to really make the argument that you cannot reduce DNA to physics and chemistry. He has a, I think it was an article called something like Life Not Reducible to Physics and Chemistry, and it gave some of the key arguments that are still being used today by intelligent design proponents.
Exactly. This is one of the reasons why we love you. You are so well researched. It's fantastic. And we're looking forward to getting into talking about your new book today. But before we do, I got to just ask some really basic questions that a lot of us would love to know. For example, do you watch much TV? And if you do, what's a favorite TV show that you watch? And I'd love to know what your day looks like. When do you do most of your writing and research?
I don't think I've been asked that question ever in an interview before. I do not watch TV. I admit I'm just not a visual person. If I have a chance to watch something versus read, I will always read. Hmm. So I don't watch TV. I listen to classical music. I'm a classically trained violinist. So I listen to classical music, and that's about it. And what my day looks like, I'll tell you my ideal day. It doesn't always work this way. But I do best if I can get up and do my heavy-duty research and thinking in the morning.
Like what time do you wake up?
I'm not a morning person. If I can, I'll stay up late and sleep late, 8 o'clock.
Okay.
But if I can, it's kind of like getting up and doing your morning exercise. It's my mental exercise. If I can get up and exercise my mind at the beginning of the day, I do much better through the rest of the day. So if I can get up, of course, I read scripture and pray first. And then if I can do some really tough, difficult mental reading, that's what I love. I love being able to dig into something very philosophical in the morning. And then I feel like I'm ready for the day.
It's interesting. I was talking to William Lane Craig about that, and he does the same thing. He says that he likes to do the heavy lifting reading in the morning, and then if he's going to be doing lighter reading, he'd do that later in the day. So you do something very similar?
I do, except that since I'm a night person, I will also pick up difficult stuff at night. That's my way to unwind.
That's
my way
fantastic.
To unwind from the day is to get back into that difficult reading. And that's not always good because I do stay up late sometimes. I do like to read at night. But what you're saying is absolutely correct. If you can get up and do tough reading in the morning, it's almost, like I said, it's almost like doing your exercises in the morning. You feel ready for the day. You feel like you're in shape. Mm-hmm. You feel like your mind has gotten its a good workout.
And when do you do your writing?
Anytime.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Anytime during the day. Writing is something I can do at any time. I don't really have to set up a special time to do that. The creative impulse is always there. I have not really understood people who have writer's block or, you know, who have trouble writing. That's just never been a problem for me. Here's the key. If you have enough input, you will have enough output.
Right.
If you're taking in ideas, if you're grappling with ideas, if you're taking in material from the best thinkers out there, then when it comes time to write, you've got enough to write. Mm-hmm. I think that's the biggest key.
You know, we're going to be talking today on your book, Love Thy Body. And I know that some people that listen to the show, maybe they haven't been introduced to your work before or you. In your introduction, you talk about how you talk about yourself as a former agnostic and that you see this book as giving an insider's roadmap to the postmodern moral ideas. Could you just give us a little bit of your background and tell us just a little bit of your story before we get into your book?
Yes, I was raised in a Christian home. It was a Lutheran home, a Scandinavian Lutheran home. And I don't know if you know what that means, but if you're in any kind of ethnic Christianity, a lot of the Christianity is not very personally relevant. A lot of it is ethnicity. It's kind of like being an Irish Catholic.
Right.
You know, Dutch Reformed because you're Dutch. Scandinavian people are Lutheran because that's their heritage. And as a result, when I was in high school, and I was attending a public high school, and all my teachers were secular, all my textbook was secular. It seemed like most of my friends were secular. They didn't go to church. And I started just asking questions. How do we know that Christianity is true? And my parents and my pastor and the people I asked were just not equipped to answer that kind of question. It was kind of like, you know, we're Swedish. What else are you going to be? If you're not Lutheran, it was very hard for them to understand what I was even asking. But I was standing outside the circle of faith already and asking, how do I know it's true? And I even asked a Christian university professor. I said, why are you a Christian? And he said, works for me.
Mm.
That's it. That's all you have. And I had a chance to talk to a Lutheran seminary dean. And I thought, well, he at least would have some better answers. But all he said was, don't worry, we all have doubts sometimes. As though it was a psychological phase that I would outgrow. So about halfway through high school, I very intentionally decided that if Christianity didn't have any answers to my questions, and then really, how could I say it was that I believed it? I mean, you shouldn't believe anything if you don't have good reasons for it, whether it's Christianity or anything. So I very intentionally set aside my whole religious upbringing and decided it was up to me to find out what was true. And I literally began going to the library in the public high school I attended and pulling books off the philosophy shelf because I thought, you know, where do people even ask these questions about what is true and how do you know it? And what's the meaning of life? And is there a foundation for ethics? Or is it just, you know, whatever's true for me and whatever's true for you, and we all just figure out what works for us? And by the time I had graduated from high school, I had pretty much become a very agnostic person. I had completely absorbed moral relativism. Among my classmates, I was the one arguing that you can't say that anything is really right or wrong. Because having been a Christian, I understood the implications of giving it up. I knew that if there wasn't a God, there really was no other firm foundation for morality. I knew that without God, there was no meaning to life. We were just on a rock flying through space. And if there was no God, I wanted to be like Bertrand Russell. I wanted to really face the implications squarely. And he says, he has that famous line where he says, the modern person must build their life on the foundation of unyielding despair. Mm-hmm. And that's what I wanted to do. If Christianity wasn't true, I wanted to face the despair honestly. Several years later, I was going to school in Germany, and we had lived there when I was a kid. So I went back to Germany, and through a series of strange coincidences, I ended up at Le Bris, which is the ministry of Francis and Edith Schaeffer. And that was the first time I ever encountered apologetics. And I was blown away. I had no idea that Christianity had any rational foundation. I had no idea that there were good arguments and good reasons that could be offered for Christianity. I was not very happy about this, by the way. By then, I had walked away from Christianity. It had let me down, and I had no intention of going back. So, in fact, I stayed at I went to Le Bris twice. The first time, I stayed only a month, and it was because I did not want this to be true. I was so impressed by Le Bris and by the fact that here were people who could actually engage with ideas, who could engage with a secular world of ideas. And not only that, but, you know, Schaeffer emphasized the arts a lot, and I was a violinist. So I really appreciated a version of Christianity that said the arts are important, that creativity is important. And on top of all that, I was there in 1971. Most of the students there were all hippies. So I was also impressed that here was a group of Christians who could reach across that cultural divide and connect with these very disaffected young people. And I thought, what kind of Christians are these? I've just never seen anybody like this before. I was so impressed, though, that I left. I was afraid I might be drawn in emotionally because it was very attractive. And I didn't want to be drawn in for emotional reasons. If I was going to go back to Christianity, which I didn't want to do, it would have to be only because I was intellectually convinced it was true. Mm-hmm. Because of my time at Le Bris, I had discovered there was such a thing as apologetics. And so that's when I discovered C.S. Lewis and G.K. Chesterton. And, of course, Schaeffer himself. I continued reading his books. And Oz Guinness, who was there at the time. Mm-hmm. And eventually, just by my own reading, I decided I was intellectually convinced. Mm-hmm. And so a year and a half later, I went back to Le Bris, stayed a longer time, and that's when I really got grounded in Christianity as a total worldview, understanding it. You know, Schaeffer was fairly unique at the time in teaching that Christianity is not just religious truth, but it's total truth. It's truth that applies to all areas of life, to science and to politics and to education, to the arts.
That might be a good place, actually, for us to jump into this conversation. Because in your book, Love Thy Body, you actually use, you talk about Francis Schaeffer a number of times, and in particular, how influential his fact-value split was for you in really understanding the mindset of what's going on in culture today. Could you speak to that?
Right, yeah. You realize, of course, that Schaeffer never actually used the term fact-value split. That itself was something that I realized only later. He used the imagery of two stories in a building, and he said the concept of truth has been split. People used to think that truth was a unity, because after all, reality is a unified system, so the truth about reality would be unified. There are natural truths, truths about the natural world, and there are moral truths, but they all form an internally consistent system. But in the modern age, with the rise of modern science in particular, many people decided the only form of reliable knowledge is empirical knowledge, was scientific knowledge. That's the fact realm. And that the realm of morality is no longer really truth at all. Morality is reduced to merely private preference and personal experience, subjective, arbitrary, personal values. And so if you think of this, you know, visualize it mentally, the fact-value split can be thought of as the two stories in a building, with the lower story are objective facts, what's scientifically knowable, and in the upper story are subjective values. So the fact-value split is the main theme of my book, Total Truth, and there I show that it is one of the greatest barriers to presenting Christian truth today, because people no longer think that religion or morality has the status of truth. Let me personalize that. That was really the main issue for me when I went to Le Bris back in 1971. Mm. is I was such a relativist that I first had to be convinced that there was such a thing as truth before I could even consider whether Christianity was that truth. And then I took it a step further in my new book, Love Thy Body. I show how that same split, if you view truth as split, it's going to affect everything. So I show that it also affects all the moral issues like abortion, assisted suicide, homosexuality, transgenderism, and even the hookup culture. That's how I build on that fact-value split in Love Thy Body.
So the title of your book, like you said, is Love Thy Body. What does that have to do with the hard questions you talk about in the subtitle? It says hard questions. The subtitle is hard questions about life and sexuality. How do those two come together?
Probably the best way to show you is through an example. Let's take the first life issue. Life issue means abortion, assisted suicide, euthanasia, and so on. So let's take abortion. Many bioethicists today will acknowledge that the fetus is human from conception. The evidence from DNA and genetics is just too strong. And so they say, yes, the fetus is human from the moment of conception. So why don't we grant it legal protection? Well, because it doesn't attain moral standing until it becomes a person, usually defined in terms of certain cognitive abilities and so on. So until then, it is merely human, with merely in quotation marks there. It is merely human, and at that level, it's just a disposable piece of matter. I mean, it can be killed for any reason or no reason. It can be used for research, tinkered with genetically, harvested for organs. The sellable parts can be picked out and sold, as Planned Parenthood has been doing, and then it can be disposed of with the other medical waste.
In other words, it's just a body at that point.
It is just a body. That's exactly it. As long as it's merely human, it's merely biologically human, it's just a body, and it has no moral standing and no right to legal protection. Mm. In fact, it's actually called personhood theory. And you can see how it's an outworking of the fact-value split. Because if you use that two-story metaphor, to be biologically human, to be a body, is a scientific fact, and that's in the lower story. But to be a person is an ethical concept defined by what we value. So that's in the upper story.
This is something that you get into in your book that I think is so important for people to understand, is that the way that you view a human being is incredibly important, in particular to how you're going to treat them.
Exactly. What does it mean to be human? And what we're seeing in the abortion issue is that it no longer is enough to be human to have human rights. Only certain humans qualify for human rights. You have to earn the right to personhood by achieving a certain level of cognitive ability, neocortical functioning, self-awareness, self-determination, or whatever. And by the way, who decides? Who decides where to draw the line between being a mere human and being a person? Mm-hmm. It's completely arbitrary and subjective. When you think about it, the change from being a mere piece of matter, a mere body that can be killed for any reason, to a person with inviolable rights is a momentous change. You should be able to detect that change, but there's no transformative point that science can detect objectively. So the definition of personhood is private, it's subjective, it's arbitrary, it's like the other personal values. And every bioethicist you read will have a different definition. And so as a result, the line is completely arbitrary and can be drawn anywhere. And we are all at risk because who knows when the line may be drawn at a place that eliminates you or me.
Speaking of that kind of cognitive capacity, like if we talk about it at the beginning of life, but that can transfer to the end of life, right? When we talk about assisted suicide, for example, we will say, for example, if that person has dementia or something like that and starts losing that cognitive capacity, all of a sudden this person, this elderly person, becomes a candidate for assisted suicide.
Yeah, exactly. I was on a radio program just the other day where the host said, I never realized that euthanasia is basically just the abortion argument in reverse. Mm-hmm. So if bioethicists defend abortion by arguing anyone who has not achieved a prescribed level of cognitive awareness is not a person, by the same token, they justify euthanasia by saying, if you lose certain cognitive abilities. You are no longer a person, even though obviously you're still human. So at that point, you can be unplugged, your treatment can be withheld, even your food and water can be discontinued, your organs can be harvested. And so again, the upshot is that the sheer fact of being biologically human no longer guarantees human rights, the right not to be killed. You have to earn the status of personhood. And this is a drastic devaluation of human life. And that's why the book is titled Love Thy Body. We need to have a higher view of what it means to be human.
Mm-hmm. And this is something that I really appreciate about your book, Nancy. And I, in fact, remember when you were here at the conference, you and I talked quite a bit about this as we as an organization were just working on a project where we just started something that we call the Human Project, and it's in fact going to be launching at our conference. I see a lot of similarities between your work and the work that we've been doing, in particular in this idea of dehumanization, and it's a word that comes up a number of times in your book. And I think that it's incredibly important for people to understand that these are more than just philosophical ideas that we're talking about here, that they have real world implications, and that these ideas are dangerous.
They're dangerous politically as well. Let's take the topics we've already talked about. In a free society, the state recognizes certain pre-political rights. That is, certain rights exist prior to the state. The state does not create them. The state merely recognizes them. So in the past, the law recognized the right to life as a pre-political right. It's something you have just because you're a member of the human race. You are biologically human. The law didn't create it. The law merely recognized it. But the only way the state could legalize abortion was to deny the relevance of biology and to declare that some humans are not persons. So you see, what the state has done is it's claimed the authority to decide arbitrarily which humans qualify for the fundamental right not to be killed. Instead of recognizing that all humans have that right prior to the state, now the state decides who has the right to life. That is an incredibly dangerous increase in state authority and the coercive power of the state.
Oh, absolutely. And one of the things that we're finding, even for example, here in Canada, you're probably aware that in 2016, euthanasia was legalized in Canada. And what I've noticed is I've talked with nurses that work in palliative care, that they have colleagues that before it was legalized thought euthanasia was wrong. Now that it's been legalized, they all of a sudden think it's right. And people are going, well, where, how did you change your view on that? Just simply because the government now says that this is an acceptable act, that all of a sudden, just because the government says that, you think that this is a correct thing to do? And one of the things that I noticed in your book that you talk about is that goes along with this is just that slippery slope argument that once you start down a path like euthanasia, and you give some really incredible examples of where that can go, to like what we're seeing in Holland with euthanasia vans.
Right. One of the arguments that I find most effective with people is to say that the pro-choice view, whether it's pro-choice for abortion or euthanasia, the pro-choice view is not compassionate. You know, euthanasia and assisted suicide are usually sold to the public as compassion. It's not compassionate. It's exclusive. It says that some people don't measure up. They don't make the cut. They don't qualify as full humans, fully persons. By contrast, it's the pro-life position that's inclusive because it says if you're a member of the human race, you're in, you count, you have the dignity and status of a full member of the moral community. And so the terms exclusive and inclusive, which is, you know, so such powerful buzz terms today, really apply here to help people see that when you deny certain people the status of being persons, you are being exclusive. And the law today is being exclusive rather than inclusive.
Speaking of inclusivity, exclusivity, and all of these things, there are a number of other hot-button political topics that you touch on. namely the issue of homosexuality and transgenderism and things like that. Now, what I hear often from transgender activists is that transgenderism is all about finding your authentic self, and somehow your body has nothing to do with it.
Yeah, exactly. Your body has nothing to do with it. You're right on target there. And that's why you can easily see in transgenderism, almost more than any other issue, you can see that what's at root of that, the transgender narrative, is a disregard, a demeaning of the body. The transgender narrative says gender has nothing to do with biological sex, and that the authentic self is strictly a matter of your inner feelings, your desires, your emotions. And so kids down to kindergarten are being taught that their bodies have nothing to do with their identity, that all that matters is your inner feelings. Or another way of putting it is, if I'm actually reading a book by a philosopher defending transgenderism right now, and this philosopher keeps saying, if you sense a disjunction between your mind and your body, the mind wins. To which we should say, why? Why accept such a demeaning view of the body? It is radically dehumanizing. You see, if our bodies do not have inherent value, then a key part of our human identity is devalued. And the transgender narrative is estranging people from their own body. Mm-hmm. After I'd already written my book, Love Thy Body, I ran across an article by a 14-year-old girl who had lived as a trans boy for 3 years. From 11 to 14, she lived as a boy. And then she recovered her identity as a girl. And she said the key to her change came about when she realized it's okay to love your body.
Wow. Wow.
And I thought, wait a minute, that's my book. To hear it from the mouth of a trans teen saying that the key to answering the charges of transgenderism is to love your body.
Can you help me understand something, Nancy, that I've been wrestling with? And, you know, I'm curious how you've wrestled with this, where you just quoted for us a philosopher on this issue that says, listen, if there's a discrepancy between your body and your mind, you go with the mind. But how does this work on a secular materialistic worldview? What do you mean by the mind? What I see in the transgender movement is that there's this cheating of the worldview where there's this materialistic view of the world, but there's also this view that there's a mind that exists, that there's this, that you can have an identity other than what your biology is.
What you have to realize is that these are moral issues. And remember, morality is in the upper story. And therefore, when moral issues come up, people's ideas are being shaped by postmodernism much more than by modernism. In other words, let's go to homosexuality as an example. So that's another hot topic, right? Mm-hmm. And once again, you know, my point is that the body is being disparaged. Nobody really denies that biologically, physiologically, chromosomally, and anatomically, males and females are counterparts to one another. That's how the human sexual and reproductive system is designed. So when someone embraces a same-sex identity, implicitly they are contradicting that design. They are saying, why should the structure of my body inform my identity? You know, why should my biological sex have any say in what my sexual desires and my moral choices should be? So it's a profoundly disrespectful view of the body. And the implication is that what counts is not whether I'm biologically male or female, but solely my mind, my feelings, my desires. So it has a very fragmenting and self-alienating effect on the human personality. And the key to it, I appreciate your question, because you're saying, wait a minute, most of our public institutions, and especially the universities, are governed by materialism, by the idea that the body is all that exists. But moral issues are being primarily addressed by postmodernism. And they're saying, okay, fine, the body is just a system of organs and cells and tissues, and so it has no higher purpose or meaning. It's up to us to decide what the meaning is. And that's where the postmodernism comes up, because it says, because the body gives us no clues to our identity, the body gives us no clues to what our moral choices should be, therefore, we decide. It's a social construct. Here's a very telling quote. you probably know the outspoken lesbian feminist Camille Paglia. Mm-hmm. She wrote a very interesting article in which she said, biologically, it is clear that nature has created us male and female. The humans are a biologically reproducing species. And then she says, but why not defy nature? Mm. Why should we be governed by nature? Because after all, nature is, I mean, ever since Darwin, we've known that nature is purposeless, meaningless, has no particular goal, or evolution has no goal or purpose in mind. So why not just defy nature? And then here's her quote. She says, fate, not God, has given us this body, and we are free to do whatever we want with it. So you see, that's where the connection is between, on the one hand, materialism has devalued the body to where it's just a piece of matter, no different from any other chance configuration of matter. And then the postmodernists come in and say, well, in that case, we can decide what we want to do with it. We are not governed at all by our physical structure, by our bodies, by our biological sex. We are free to impose whatever meaning we want on our body. So it's that interaction between a materialist viewpoint, which is modernist, and a postmodern viewpoint. That interaction is what you need to catch, because that's the key.
I've never thought about that, in that, in particular, how this informs transhumanism. It gives really a different lens to see the transhumanist movement, I think. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, exactly. I have a section in the book on transhumanism, and it's saying the same thing. You're right. There's nothing special about human nature, so why should we respect it? Why should we protect it? Why not advance to a higher level of evolution? So in a sense, humanism is saying humans are nothing special. Why not use technology to create a new stage of life beyond humanity? And so transhumanists say it's time to take charge of evolution through genetic engineering. Human life as it exists today is merely one step in an endless evolutionary chain. Mm. It's just a chance configuration of cells that will be surpassed in the next stage of evolution. And so you're absolutely right. That's another example of where secular thought today is based on a denigration of the body, on a denigration of what it means to be human.
Then would you say that the transgender movement could be viewed as a type of transhumanism?
Oh, yeah. I hadn't made that connection directly, but that is a good idea. See, I think this is where we have to help people who recognize the importance of science and the evolutionary theory for all of these moral issues. Because the reason a secular ethic has such a low regard for biology, for being biologically human, is that it sees all of nature as a cosmic accident. It's a product of blind material forces. It has no higher purpose or meaning. And the human body is reduced to a collection of atoms and cells and tissues. And what's the implication then? The implication is our bodies convey no moral message, give no clue to our identity. They have no inherent purpose that we're obligated to respect, that we're the ones who decide what's right and wrong, and morality is reduced to a subjective choice. And you see, that's why a Christian ethic always takes into account the facts of biology, whether it's addressing abortion, the scientific facts about when life begins, or when it's addressing sexuality, the facts about sexual differentiation and reproduction. The Christian ethic treats the human being as a psychophysical unity, that both body and person are expressions of the unique self. It has a much higher view of the body than the secular view.
Some critic might say, well, you know, Nancy, that's all well and good that it, you know, on Christianity, it's a psychosomatic union and all of these things. But in a Western liberal democracy that we have here, why would we go out of our way to stop other people from doing what they want with their bodies? If people are just doing what they want and they're not hurting anybody else, is it our place to stop people from doing what they want to do? How would you respond to that?
I think I would respond in two ways. First of all, I would help them to realize that, let me quote one of my students just last night in my class. She said to me, "You're helping us learn to like ourselves." I thought that was an interesting way of putting it. You're helping us learn to like ourselves, to value ourselves. I think our first way of reaching out to secular people is to help them to see that the secular view is destructive. It's tearing them down. It's teaching them a very low view of their own selves, of their own bodies. It's teaching them a low view, first, of their body, and then secondly, that morality is just a social construction as well. And you guys are apologists. You have good arguments against both of those. But we have to help people to see that if you want to learn to like yourself, you need to reconsider the secular ethic. If you want morality to be more than just a social construct that, you know, you either make up or take from your own society, and there's no really right or wrong. I mean, nobody wants to live with that. Mm. We all want to know that there's a true good and a true evil, and that when we're making our choices, we can really be choosing a good and not just what seems right to us at the moment. So I think that we reach out to people by showing them that the Christian view actually gives greater dignity and value and significance to the human person. And secondly, I think I would go back to the political issues and show them how destructive it is when the state is given greater coercive power. Let's take homosexuality. In the past, the state recognized marriage as a pre-political right. Remember, pre-political means the state does not create the right, it merely recognizes it. And marriage was based on the fact that humans are sexually reproducing species. So the state has nothing to do with it. The state can regulate it somewhat, but the state basically recognizes it as something that exists prior to the state. But the only way the law can treat same-sex couples the same as opposite-sex couples is to deny the relevance of biology and to redefine marriage as just an emotional commitment. And that's what the Supreme Court did in its Obergefell decision, which legalized same-sex marriage. But listen, we all know there are endless varieties of emotional commitments. So as a result, the state has claimed the authority to decide arbitrarily which ones qualify as marriage. This is a huge power grab on the part of the state. Mm. It is now defining marriage rather than recognizing it as a pre-political right. Mm. Or transgenderism, the only way the law can treat a trans woman who's born male the same as a biological woman is, again, to deny that biology has any relevance and to declare gender to be a matter of inner feelings. And that's why the state has claimed the authority to start telling us who we must call he or she. So you see, in all of these moral issues, pre-political rights are being destroyed and reduced to merely legal rights at the dispensation of the state. And of course, what the state gives, the state can take away, and human rights are no longer inalienable.
I think a lot of people would be surprised today that Christianity has such a high view of the body and that we only value the spiritual realm. Is this true?
It is true. And you're right. Some people are very surprised by that because they're kind of caught in a sacred secular split where, as one of my students put it, I was always taught body bad, spirit good. That's how she summarized it. And I think a lot of people do have that notion. And I think one of the best ways to counter that is to recover our own heritage. You know, when Christianity started out, the early church was surrounded by philosophies that denied the body, that denied the value of the material realm. Philosophies like Platonism and Gnosticism and even Manichaeism. Remember, Augustine was a Manichae before he became a Christian.
Right.
So these were live options at the time. And all of them treated the material world as the place of death, decay, and destruction. They talked about the body as a prison. Plato talked about the prison house of the body. In Gnosticism, the world is actually created by a low-level deity. There were several levels of spiritual beings, and this world was created by a low-level deity who was actually an evil god, because no self-respecting god would get his hands dirty mucking about with matter. So in this context, Christianity was revolutionary. It taught that it was not a low-level God. It was the highest God. It was the supreme deity who created the material world. And what's more, he pronounced it very good. And an even greater scandal historically was the incarnation. The idea that this supreme deity entered into the material world and took on a human body. So the incarnation is the ultimate affirmation of the dignity of the body. And finally, at the end of time, God is not going to scrap the material world as if he made a mistake the first time around. Instead, he's going to renew it and restore it and create a new heavens and a new earth. So the Apostles' Creed affirms the resurrection of the body. This is an astonishingly high view of the physical world. There's nothing like it in any other philosophy or religion. And that's why my book, Love Thy Body, gives people the tools to go beyond a negative message, right? It's wrong, it's sinful, the thou shalt not messages. Yep. Though they're true, but they're incomplete, because what we also need to do is deploy positive arguments. We need to show that a biblical ethic has a high view of the body of this world. It gives people more dignity, more status, more significance, and that as a result, the biblical message is very appealing. It's more appealing and more attractive than any secular ethic.
Well, Nancy, time is quickly getting away on us here. So as we close, if our listeners want to learn more about your work, where can they go?
They can go. I do have a website called nancypiercy.com, and you can see my other books there. My husband has a website that I'm a part of as well called Piercy Report. So nancypiercy.com or piercyreport.com are two good places.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Nancy. It was a real treat and pleasure to have you on the show.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed talking with you.
So check it out, Love Thy Body, Answering Hard Questions About Life and Sexuality, published by Baker Books. Go to Amazon or wherever you go to get your books and make sure you get a copy. Well, thank you, listeners, for joining us on this show. The Apologetics Canada podcast has been a ministry of Apologetics Canada, and we'll see you next week with more stuff to think about. Until then, ciao.
If you enjoy and appreciate the AC Podcast, show us some love on iTunes. Please consider leaving a review. It helps us keep doing what we're doing.